From the studios, 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Buzzwords this week and early 2021 may be the buzzword in the motor industry this year, and we at 30 Laps are all over it. FEV, for short, well, you bet. But what's a FEV, 30 Laps? Stick with me, and I'll tell ya. Also, classics up for grabs. Well, perhaps it doesn't help to dream, especially on this show. Grab your motoring dreams. Let's do a few laps around these beauties. A quintet of desires, you might say. Oh, and something else. One of the best car storytellers ever. My dad. It's his birthday today. He's 106. Or at least he would have been if he hadn't passed away in 1993. Oh, and talking about pursuits, well, we were in February last year. How about the info from some of the greatest car chases in the movies? Seatbelts on, tight, let's go. This week in 30 Laps. Okay, let's get cracking, shall we? So, first up, from the Life and Leisure magazine of the Australian Finance Review, the 13th to 15th of November last, by Tony Davis, Power Plays. Car makers step up the gas on the PEV, P-H-E-V, market. Let's find out what that's all about. Your next car may well be a PEV, P-H-E-V. Or plug-in hybrid electric vehicle. It's not a particularly attractive name, but the term is needed to distinguish it from other electric vehicles on sale. These include HEV, HEV, hybrid electric vehicles, which cannot be charged from an external source, and BEV, BEV, a pure battery electric vehicle. FEV, PHEV, crikey, lots of acronyms here, commonly pronounced FEV, there you go, promises the advantages of petrol and electric drivetrains. This means you can drive silently and emissions-free to work and back during the week, charging at home each night and then using the conventional piston engine for long-distance driving on the weekend. Most luxury makers now have PEVs on sale, and some such as Ferrari's SF90 Stradale, due here at the end of 2021, and the ultra-rare McLaren Speedtail are among the fastest cars on the road. There are different philosophies at play. Porsche started with FEV sedans and SUVs that were merely more economical and efficient than standard models. The German company soon discovered a few were looking for a Porsche that was greener, unless it was also faster. So the company pivoted to make sure that if there is a FEV version of the model line, it should be very fast. It recently announced three FEV versions of the Panamera sedan, topping with their Turbo SE hybrid. This is priced at more than $420,800. Plus on road. It can accelerate from rest to 100 k's in 3.2 seconds. Yet it also has an official fuel figure as low as 2.7 litres per 100 kilometres and an emission target or emission reading of 62 grams per kilometre. That's according to the European figures. Local figures will be available soon. Aside from this, Porsche has e-hybrid versions of its Cayenne and Cayenne Coupe SUVs starting at 141,000 plus on road, with a larger battery available from early next year. The Sport Turismo version of the Panamera is also due. Mercedes, not to be outdone, boasts its latest FEV S-Class limousine to be seen here late this year. and will be good for 100 kilometres before the petrol engine kicks in. It's being pitched as an electric limousine for the working week and a conventional tourer for the weekend. Even the smaller FEVs from Benz are now have increased range. The C300C sedan drove recently, 84,000 plus on road, delivered 40 electric kilometres in real world urban conditions and could be charged at the end of the day on a domestic power point. That's plenty for most people to commute daily with no local emissions, and it's fun to drive. Benz also has a FEV version of its entry model A-Class from $63,400, its E-Class sedan from $121,000, and its GLC SUV from $86,000. It claims it will have 25 FEVs by 2025. Land Rover Jaguar will reportedly have 7 by 2021. That's this year, folks. Although not all will make it here. Currently, there are 3 FEV Range Rovers for sale in Australia, ranging in price from $134,000 to $211,925. Next year should bring us the FEV Bentley Bentayga and much more. BMW has updated its FEV 5 Series sedan. It starts at $120,900. Its other FEV offerings start with the 330e and take in the BMW X5 xDrive 45e at $133,000. And a version of its flagship limousine known as the 745e at $209,900. Crikey. And there's some other versions here from Lexus and Volvo, which I won't bore you to death with now. But car makers find FEV appealing because they are much cheaper than BEV for themselves and consumers. And they help companies meet fleet average CO2 legislation, which is tightening sharply in Europe and will probably rise again in a US post-Trump. Little surprise, perhaps, is the FEV is eating away at the diesel. In the past 4 years, BMW has lopped away about a quarter of its oil burners, while its Mini brand, which offers the Countryman Hybrid here in Australia at $60,900 plus on road, has gone from 13 diesel variants internationally to just 2. VW, the brand synonymous with Dieselgate, has halved its offerings and Volvo has slashed them by 2/3. And this is really what I wanted to tell you about in this article, not so much the price of things, but how manufacturers are looking at this market. But despite the near, I'll go back to that story now, if you like. But despite the near miraculous efficiency of a FEV on paper, you don't get something for nothing. Aside from being appreciably dearer than conventional models, most FEVs we have driven feel heavy. They are. And occasionally indecisive, hesitating before deciding which power source to use. Some also have an inconsistent brake pedal feel, almost certainly related to the regenerative braking. Research from Britain and Europe, where there are serious tax breaks for FEVs, suggests buyers often bank the incentives but lose interest in plugging in. The result is that these cars are achieving nowhere near their environmental claims they are capable of. In fact, they are even worse than internal combustion engine cars because those heavy batteries take extra energy to cart around. The same could happen here with the FEV company cars that come with fuel cards in the glove box. On the other hand, a diligent buyer who plugs in regularly and completes mainly short journeys can easily beat the official fuel consumption and emission figures, something that can really be achieved in an internal combustion engine car. Thank you, Tony Davis, for that interesting insight into the FEV market in Australia. And it was from the Life and Leisure section of the Australian Financial Review, 13th to 15th of November last year. That was the great John Hiatt singing a song called, ironically enough, The Open Road. Let's move on. Let's talk about some classics up for sale, shall we? From drive.com.au, William Davis writes, it's been well documented that the price of used cars has risen during the pandemic, following a shortage of new cars due to production delays caused by the coronavirus and a surge in the number of workers moving away from public transport to avoid being infected with COVID-19. However, some truly exotic machinery is up for grabs if your budget stretches that far. Or if, like us, you like to dream. We like to dream here on 30 Laps. Here's what we found so far. A 1993 Jaguar XJ220. Of the approximately 270 XJ220s built, fewer than 70 were right-hand drive. You can currently bag one in Queensland for a cool $799,500. The concept was a collaborative effort between Jaguar and engineering company Tom Walkinshaw Racing. It was originally promoted as a V12 4x4. However, the production model is powered by a 3.5-litre turbo V6. Drive is sent to the rear wheels via a 5-speed manual transmission, and the car will go from 0 to 100 in 3.6 seconds. This variant has driven just 7,984 kilometres since new. Crikey, a 1964 Aston Martin DB5. The Aston Martin DB5 was immortalised by James Bond and accordingly is extremely desirable among collectors. Only 1,000 or so cars were ever built, but you can currently get your hands on one in New South Wales for an eye-watering $1,690,000. Unfortunately, this variant isn't equipped with the machine guns or oil slicks, unlike the British band modern take on the classic. However, it does have the original 4-litre naturally aspirated straight-six power plant, producing an impressive 210 kilowatts. It's paired with a 4-speed manual gearbox and is enough to launch the car from 0 to 100 in around 8 seconds. It's the most travelled car on the list, having clocked 89,990 since new. Yeah, well, if I owned that, I'd want to drive it all the time too. Let's move to a 68 Ford Shelby GT500. The GT500 is one of the most revered examples of American muscle, and one is currently on the market in South Australia for $299,990. The vehicle, which is a performance-enhanced variant of the Ford Mustang, is powered by a 7-litre naturally aspirated V8, 268 kilowatts. Powertrain is paired with a 3-speed automatic transmission. Extensive fiberglass bodywork means the car weighs just 1470 kilos and allows it to accelerate from 0 to 100 in around 5 seconds. This example has done just 17,225 kilometres since it rolled off its Michigan production line more than 50 years ago. Staying with all things American, a 1966 Chevrolet Corvette Stingray. Perhaps the most sought-after out of all the Chevrolet Corvette variants. The Stingray C2 was produced between 63 and 67. There's one lying around at the moment. It's a 66 in Victoria for $389,990. The car's 7-litre V8 produces 317 kilowatts and its power is sent to the wheels via a close ratio Munchie 4-speed manual gearbox. This example has 69,247 kilometres on the clock and was fully restored prior to its listing. And last but not least, a 1991 Ferrari F40 Whiskers. This example of Ferrari's legendary turbocharged supercar is listed in New South Wales for $2,390,900. The thick end of it should be 2.4 really, but anyway. And it's just got 8,899 kilometres on the clock. Designed to celebrate the brand's 40th anniversary, the F40 was the last model personally approved by Enzo himself. It's a mid-mounted 2.9-litre turbocharged V8, 351 kilowatts. Power to the road is 5-speed manual gearbox, and this launches the 1,100-kilometre vehicle from 0 to 100 in 4.2 seconds. Just 1,315 examples of this car exist worldwide, and only a tiny handful are believed to be in Australia. Thank you, William Davis from dive.com.au. Doesn't hurt to dream, hey? Wow. What's next, 30 laps? Ooh, you had one of those vehicles that we just talked about, one of those beauties, you'd be hauling too. That's the name of that song. We're right up to date with the music so far. Let's go to Auto Car Magazine, the best cars from the best movie car chases. Al Sutty writes, from the 23rd of November last year, from television to the big screen, car chases are a staple of the movies. And it looks like the new James Bond film, No Time to Die, will have a bunch of them. The only problem is we'll have to wait. Well, we still don't know when, how long we'll have to wait, but we'll still have to wait as its arrival has been delayed, like everything else, by the coronavirus. So in the meantime, let's take a look at the best cars to appear in movie chase scenes. Whether it's perfect reality or just the most memorable stunts, we've listed the best movie chase cars in chronological order of film release. Let's get cracking. This sounds good. A Sunbeam Alpine. The movie, Dr. No. James Bond may be inseparable from his Aston Martin cars, but this first on-screen car used in his first on-screen car chase was the 61 Sunbeam Alpine Series 2. It was needed at short notice. The Alpine was borrowed from a local in Jamaica, as it was the only sports car the film crew could find. There are no stunts or gadgets for this car, as it had to be returned to its owner in one piece. So instead, we get a spirited chase with Bond pursued by villains driving a 1939 LaSalle funeral coach. Presumably too valuable to wreck, a visually similar 1949 Humber Super Snipe Mark II hearse was chucked off a cliff at the end instead. And luckily for Bond, the Alpine was a step up from the Hillman Minx sedan the original author Ian Fleming had him driving in the book that inspired the film. Nearly 20,000 Series 2 Alpines were made. The Alpine spawned a celebrated V8 power plant that was called the Tiger. Now, it can't be all bad. 30 laps, you're listening to this. We get to mention the Aston Martin DB5 twice in two different stories. Gee, I look after you. Goldfinger 1964. Who can remember that? The Aston Martin DB5 from Goldfinger, the quintessential Bond car. In its first chase scene, it's rather tame against a Ford Mustang convertible, but it's a chance to see the DB5's gadgets in action, as Bond uses sat-nav to track the villain and then tyre shredders that extend from the wheels to disable the Ford. The modifications to the Aston were made by special effects maestro John Steers, 1934 to 1999, who convinced the British car maker to give him a DB5 prototype to use. To get the best value from the work, the Aston was used again in Thunderball, while another DB5 returned for GoldenEye in 1995. There have been DB5s in most Bond films since, including the upcoming No Time to Die. A total of 1,059 DB5s were produced between 1963 and 1965. What's next, 30 laps? Well, a Jaguar S-Type, the movie Robbery, 1967. Before British director Peter Yates made his name with Bullet, he filmed Robbery in London. In fact, it was the opening chase in this 1967 movie that landed Yates the job in the USA when Steve McQueen saw the film. Helping Yates make such a great show was the Jaguar S-Type, used by the police to pursue the baddies in a Jaguar Mark II. Shot in Kensington and Ladbroke Grove in West London, much of the chase was filmed in the early morning to avoid traffic. Look closely and you can see several spot locations were used more than once in the final film, which is something Yates did again with Bullet. The S-Type was powered by 3.8 litre straight six. A whole 24,993 examples were produced between 63 and 68. We have a favourite of mine here. In fact, I did some homework last weekend and watched it again. It's, you know, the things I do for you guys and ladies and gentlemen. Ford Mustang Bullet, 1968. Arguably as much of a star of the 68 film as its lead actor, Steve McQueen, the Highland Green GT350 version of the Mustang is now legendary. Ford lent Warner Brothers two Mustangs for the film, but both received uprated brakes, engines and suspension to cope with the stunts that involved a lot of driving up and down San Francisco Bernal Heights district. McQueen did much of the driving in the 10-minute long car chase himself, though his long-standing stunt double, Bud Edkins, drove the more dangerous stunts. In the bad guy's 68 Dodge Charger 440 Magnum RT, the driver was stuntman Bill Hickman, who also played the part in the film as one of the hitmen. Hickman. One of the original film cars sold for $3.4 million early last year. Introduced in 1964, the Mustang is one of the most celebrated cars ever made. Now in its sixth generation, the 10 millionth example was built in 2018. Mini Cooper. We talked about Mini Cooper and Tommy Cooper, his older brother, a couple of weeks ago. The Italian Job, 1969. The cast of cars used in the Italian Job is every bit as glamorous as the actors, from a Lamborghini Miura through to an Aston Martin DB4, Fiat Dino and Jaguar E-Types, and the star, the Mini Cooper S, finished in patriotic British red, white and blue. The definitive 1960 car sealed its cool factor as the three Minis hurtled through Turin and tied the police in knots with a stash of stolen gold. While much of the filming was completed in Italy, including on top of Fiat's Lingotto factory, the brilliant scene with the cars slithering inside a sewage tunnel was filmed in Stoke Aldermere near Coventry. Each car had to be craned into the tunnel to film the sequence. The stunt was the work of Frenchman Remy Julien, who went on to set up his own stunt driving business on the strength of his work in this film. Relaunched under BMW ownership in 2000, the Mini remains one of the UK's most famous car brands. The movie was remade in 2003 and set in Los Angeles. It's good, but it's nothing like the original. Pontiac Le Mans from The French Connection in 1971. Gene Hackman's Popeye Doyle is a downbeat cop, so it's inevitable he grabs an equally rough at the edges car when he has to chase a suspect who's on a train. It leads to one of the best chase sequences ever filmed as the 1971 Pontiac Le Mans charges through Brooklyn, New York, the stunt driver Bill Hickman once again. Although the film's producers had permission to film on the train, they were no permits for the cars driving up to 90 miles an hour in real traffic. At one point, a local driver is hit by Hackman and his real-life scene was kept in the film. The producers then had to pay for the unsuspecting driver's car to be repaired. I bet. However, these problems were more easily smoothed over as the two genuine cops that Hackman and co-star Roy Schneider's characters were based on acted as consultants on the film and still had plenty of friends in the police force. Also from 1971, Jewel. The tension in the 1971 Jewel film centres around the hide-and-seek battle between a Plymouth Valiant and the sinister Peterbilt truck chasing it. The Valiant is well matched, its driver's character as a travelling salesman, as it is a very mundane car. There are six different Valiants used in that filming, a 70, V8, a 71 and a 72, both with slant six-cylinder engines. The original version of Jewel was filmed on a 74-minute television film by Steven Spielberg. But he later added 16 minutes of action, mostly between car and truck, to turn it into a cinema movie and a cult hit. The Valiant was Chrysler's entry into the fast-growing compact class in 1959. The nameplate ran until 1976 across four model generations and was a big seller for most of the period of production. So we might leave it there at 1971. The other one, 1971, was Vanishing Point, which it was an amazing movie, and we'll do that one shortly. But yeah, Jewel, an interesting movie. I only saw it again recently. It is a cult movie. Stick with it because it's a Spielberg and everything he does. I'd watch that main paint a fence. It's just brilliant. Good stuff. We might leave the stunts there and we'll pull another couple of stunts shortly in another episode. Interesting, some of that stuff. That is where we'll leave 30 laps today. We've done our 30 laps. I hope you've enjoyed the show, as usual, as much as I have enjoyed bringing it to you. The show is written and produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH for the 2RPH network. What do we got next week? Well, you're going to have to wait and see. It'll be something motoring orientated or oriented as well. So we'll leave it there, folks. Thanks for your company. I look forward to catching up with you again next Saturday night at 7:30. Until then, bye for now.